And good afternoon, everybody. I'm glad you're with us today. I'm Tom Hall. You're listening to Midday. 6 days ago, Americans elected Donald Trump to be the 45th president of the United States. Almost immediately after the results were in, anti-Trump protests and rallies sprung up in cities across the country, including here in Baltimore. People are taking to social media to express their dissent using hashtags like NotMyPresident. And despite calls for unity from President Obama, Secretary Hillary Clinton, and the president-elect himself, it doesn't seem likely that the anti-Trump sentiments will dissipate anytime soon.
Donald Trump is going to be our president. We owe him an open mind and the chance to lead.
We're not Democrats first. We're not Republicans first. We are Americans first. We're patriots first.
To all Republicans and Democrats and independents across this nation, I say it is time for us to come together as one united people.
So how do the more than 64 million Americans who did not vote for Donald Trump come together and reconcile their moral and ethical stances given Donald Trump's consistently offensive rhetoric over the last 18 months? Do Americans who are vehemently offended by the president-elect's comments about Mexican immigrants, Muslims, women, African Americans, prisoners of war, and disabled people have a civic or ethical responsibility to set aside their differences and support the new president? Since the election, more than 200 hate crimes have been reported around the country. How do minorities who felt targeted during the campaign cope with the fear of being retaliated against by Trump supporters or marginalized by Trump's policies? And if we don't come together, if we can't come together, then what? In Friday's Washington Post, Leon Wieseltier says that the political liberty we cherish in this precious republic is most purely and exhilaratingly experienced as the liberty to oppose. So what, then, is the proper way to be part of the loyal opposition? Well, today on Midday, we'll explore these and other questions with three guests whose expertise are in ethics and psychology. Hugh Taft Morales is the leader of the Baltimore Ethical Society and the Philadelphia Ethical Society. He joins me in the studio. It's nice to meet you, sir. Thanks.
Nice to be here, Tom.
Dr. Lakita Carter joins us on the phone from Baltimore. She's a licensed psychologist in private practice and the owner of the Institute for Healing, LLC. Previously, she was the director of the psychology division for Loyola Clinical Centers in Baltimore. Dr. Carter, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Jack Marshall joins us on the line from Boston. He's the president and founder of Pro Ethics, an ethical training and consulting firm. Mr. Marshall, thank you as well.
Thank you, Tom. Good to be here.
You are welcome to join us. Our telephone number, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. And our Twitter handle, if you'd like to send us a tweet, @MiddayTomHall. We'd like to know, how are you responding to the election now that we're almost 1 week out? So, Hugh Morales, let me start with you. Is there, in fact, an ethical obligation among for Americans to unify and to in some way, to some degree, rally around the person who was elected as the president?
I think there's an ethical obligation to rally around the executive branch and our government. I don't think there's an ethical obligation to, quote-unquote, set aside your differences with the president. In fact, I think one of the best ways to show your love for the country is to be clearer about the differences you have. Clearly, Trump is going to have a great deal of power, but the idea of rolling over and allowing the sorts of things that we have opposed over the campaign, including the bigotry and marginalization of people of color and immigrants and women and LGBTQ people, no, I don't think we should roll over in that regard, but to engage, yes.
So in what way is that an expression of love of country, showing that opposition?
Well, the loyal opposition, I mean, that comes from a parliamentary background, but I still think it's a very important. I think agreeing to get along gets us into a great deal of difficulty and problems. If the ideals that you hold, that we hold at the Ethical Society, the inherent worth of every individual and social justice, if you compromise those in order to get along with whoever is at the head of the pyramid, I think we've lost the soul of our country.
Dr. Carter, you counsel people individually. You teach, or you have taught at least at some point, people who are going to become counselors. How do you counsel people who are currently feeling incredibly fearful, who have witnessed this very divisive campaign over the past year and a half, and who are, you know, feeling. I have a lot of people tell me they haven't felt like this since 9/11. It's that kind of you know, profound profound emotional reaction. What do you say to folks who are feeling that way these days?
Well, one of the things we do is we give those people, those persons, space to talk about what this means. I have heard that in my office. I haven't experienced this type of loss, no pun intended, since 9/11. And that is incredibly painful because that was the worst day one of the worst days in American history. And yet people are feeling the fear, anxiety, concern, frustration, sadness, and vulnerability that we are open to attack from anyone. And anyone includes international or a domestic threat. We are open to attack. And that's what I saw after 9/11, that there was this fear of vulnerability that we hadn't had. And that is what I'm seeing now, this fear of vulnerability that, you know, I'm not sure if my children are safe with other children because of the parents, the homes that children are coming from. Definitely been seen an increase in racist rhetoric and sexist rhetoric among elementary school students. You know, so that's a huge fear, and we give space to people to talk about those things.
And Jack Marshall, in Boston, your company, if I understand it correctly, counsels corporate clients about ethical standards that they uphold in their corporate environments. Do I have that correct?
That's right, but also all professionals of all kind, as well as lawyers and government employees.
And what's your take on the election and the citizenry in terms of their ethical obligations at this moment in time?
I think as a result of the irresponsible rhetoric on both sides, the degree of sort of unreasonable hysteria at this point is very, very harmful and needs to be put in historical perspective. What has always been the great strength of the country and of the office of the presidency is whoever is elected automatically assumes the mantle of Washington and Lincoln and Franklin Delano Roosevelt and others and is given the presumption of wanting the best for the country and of being trustworthy, no matter how controversial they were, whether they were Richard Nixon, whether they were Andrew Jackson or Ronald Reagan. They immediately took on that, and the majority of the country, as they should, said this president is starting clean, and we will give this president our full loyalty and trust until that president proves otherwise. And there is no reason to treat Donald Trump any differently than that. And to the degree that we do, we undermine really the institutions that keep the United States strong. And I think it's a very, very dangerous thing to do. It's particularly ironic and I would say hypocritical after the late protests and outrage when Donald Trump said in a debate that he might not accept the results of the election. After that, and after he was pummeled by the media and mocked by the Democrats, it is his opponents that have come out on the street rioting and apparently, you know, and apparently not accepting the results of the election. Chris Matthews, who, you know, is an old Massachusetts Paul, was, you know, basically puzzled. I saw him on MSNBC. He said, "I don't understand. What are they protesting? They lost." And when you lose in the American election system, everybody comes together and say, okay, this is a democracy, this is a republic, and now we step back and we support each other. And that's the attitude, the ethical approach that should be taken now. What Donald Trump has done in the past, what stupid things he said, how his various comments have been interpreted, those should be put aside and he should be given the chance to unify the country. And all of this, all of the terror and upset and fear is really unwarranted and frankly undermines the bonds that hold the country together, and I'm very concerned about it.
Well, Mr. Marshall, it's only been a week. We don't know whether or not these protests will continue. Use the word riot. Only one protest, to my knowledge, has resulted in violence. That was in Portland a few days ago. But all the others have been peaceful. In what way do you define these this reaction to Mr. Trump as hysteria? Because I just wonder if you, in fact, find an equivalency between Mr. Trump's rhetoric and the rhetoric of any recent presidential candidates, and whether or not you don't think that this is an extraordinary situation in any way.
I think it's extraordinary. I think his rhetoric was beyond the pale. I think his lack of civility and boorishness and bullying and all the things we know about is way outside the realm of what is acceptable discourse in American politics. However, I think that the suggestion that every voter for Donald Trump was in fact endorsing misogyny, endorsing racism, and endorsing xenophobia is, you know, intentionally to misinterpret it and to basically go along with the process of demonizing half the country of the United States and saying these are the enemy. And as I read essays and hear comments on social media, this should have stopped. Many had commented that, you know, Governor Romney and John McCain were also called Nazis and misogynists and racists. And, you know, Bill Maher got on his show and say, I want to apologize to Romney and McCain because we called them all those things. But this guy really is a racist and a misogynist. Well, you know what? All of that rhetoric has been inflamed and inflammatory, and is basically used to seed distrust and hate, and it needs to be put aside now. There is nothing that we know of to be afraid of. What we have is a man who is still an American, was born in this country, and like every single president we've had, wants to do the best he can in the job, wants to be remembered fondly as successful, and he will try to do what it is. This is not the first time in American presidential history that a lot of the country has been terrified of a new president. They were terrified of Andrew Jackson. They were terrified of Ronald Reagan. When Chester A. Arthur became president after the assassination of Garfield, everybody believed he was a total corrupt hack, which he was. And yet he rose out of that expectation to leave the office with the affection and honor of everybody because he rose above it. So did Harry Truman. We have to give Trump the chance to be the best he can be, and the way to do that is to feel supported by the public and for him to feel that everybody supports him and that he does not have enemies looping around every corner. And
Jack Marshall joins us on the line from Boston. He's an ethicist and the president and founder of ProEthics. It's an ethical training and consulting firm. On the phone from Baltimore is Dr. Lakita Carter. She's a licensed psychologist and the owner of the Institute for Healing. Here in the studio with me, Hugh Taft Morales, who leads the Baltimore Ethical Society and the Philadelphia Ethical Society. You're listening to Midday on 88.1. I'm Tom Hall. Hugh Taft Morales, before we go to a break, is it possible that those on the left, when we talk about treating everybody as equal and people who deserving of respect, for all the talk of inclusiveness on the left, the coalition certainly did not include what Mrs. Clinton at one point referred to as the basket of deplorables, the people who were showing up at Trump rallies and espousing some pretty radical views on the right? Is it an ethical matter to accept the sort of fundamental moral premise of a member of the KKK whose newspaper endorsed Mr. Trump, or a person holding a Confederate flag at a Trump rally? I mean, where does one draw the line?
Well, look, I think if Elizabeth Warren and Dave Chappelle can both say they want to give Trump a chance, I think that's something that I'm willing to do as well. But it's another thing to claim that there's unwarranted upset and unreasonable hysteria if the people who are really threatened, those marginalized in our community, in a more divided, economically divided community than we've ever seen, they are in danger. And I'm willing to give President Trump a chance, but already putting Steve Bannon in a position of power when there are clearly dangerous things. It's not just words. Trump has whipped up a counter movement of people feeling that they're now entitled to take action, and I think that is dangerous. Yes, we have to give him a chance, but we have to be very, very careful not to pretend like, oh, now we can just go on with things as usual.
All right. We're going to talk about Steve Bannon when we come back. He's the former head of Breitbart News and the current chairman of the Trump election campaign. Hugh Taft Morales is the leader of the Baltimore Ethical Society and the Philadelphia Ethical Society. Dr. Lakita Carter is on the phone with us. She's a psychologist and the owner of the Institute for Healing. Jack Marshall is the president and founder of ProEthics. We've got lots of folks on the phone. We will get to all of those calls as soon as we come back. You are welcome to join us, 410-662-8780. Our email address, midday@wipr.org. Our Twitter handle, @MiddayTomHall. We'll be right back. Hang around. And welcome back to Midday, everybody. I'm Tom Hall. We're talking about what else? The election. By the way, coming up tomorrow, we'll talk with Plank Industries CEO Tom Geddes. The ink is dry on the Port Covington development deal, but many questions still remain about what this massive project will mean for residents in the coming years. Tom Geddes will take my questions and yours tomorrow on Midday. If you're just joining us today, we're talking about the call to unify the country after the unparalleled divisiveness of the presidential campaign. We've got three guests. Hugh Taft Morales is the leader of the Baltimore Ethical and the Philadelphia Ethical Society. He's here in the studio. Dr. Lakita Carter joins us on the phone. She's a licensed psychologist in private practice, and she owns the Institute for Healing. Formerly, she was the director of the psychology division for Loyola Clinical Centers in Baltimore. And Jack Marshall's on the phone in Boston. He's the president and founder of ProEthics, an ethical training and consulting firm. If you'd like to weigh in, we'd love to hear from you. We will try to get to as many calls as we can. Our phone number, 410-662-8780. Our email address, midday@wipr.org, and our Twitter handle, @MiddayTomHall. Dr. Carter, before we go to some callers, when a person presents to you with the affect of a narcissist, which is a description that Mr. Trump has been it's been used to describe Mr. Trump, how do you react to that person? If a person comes to you saying, "It looks like I'm a narcissist, I want help," how do you help that person?
It's an interesting question because that rarely happens. Narcissists actually don't identify with having any sort of problem that needs to be treated, and rarely do they present to treatment because of that type of personality style. They present to treat if they present to treatment, they present because there's some sort of crisis or acute moment in their lives, like a spouse saying, if you don't work on yourself, then I'm going to leave. But even then, most narcissists would find that to be okay, because that means that something's wrong with you and nothing's wrong with me, who would leave someone this amazing. So it's actually not very common for narcissists to present to treatment unless there's been some acute thing happening, like maybe a trauma. But they wouldn't present with any sort of concern about self. It would be about how they've been victimized.
Mm-hmm. And what about folks who are married to narcissists or have good friends who are narcissists or who've been perhaps victimized, if you will, by a narcissistic personality? What do you tell them?
Oftentimes those people feel abused, they feel unheard, they feel vulnerable and attacked regularly, especially if there is not agreement. So there's no sort of conflict when there's agreement between, you know, what we're going to do for dinner or where we're going to move. But as soon as there is disagreement and dissension, then they find themselves feeling alone, attacked, abused by their partners or friends, and ultimately they decide whether that friendship or that relationship is a positive one in their lives and go from there. Oftentimes those people are the people who present to treatment to deal with their loved ones. And I just want to add that the idea that there's nothing to fear at this point is an idea that comes from a place of privilege, because many, many people who are underprivileged, and that would include gender minorities and racial minorities, ethnic minorities, so sexual orientations, religious minorities, would actually not agree with that at all, that the rhetoric used actually is something to fear, that words have power and that words mean something and they can be very hurtful, and words can often demonstrate how we think and how we will behave in the future. So the idea that there's nothing to fear at this point, I'm not sure that's a really a feasible idea.
That's Dr. Lakita Carter. She's a licensed psychologist and the owner of the Institute for Healing here in Baltimore. Hugh Taft Morales is a leader of the Baltimore and Philadelphia Ethical Societies. He's with me in the studio. Jack Marshall is the president and founder of ProEthics, an ethical training and consulting firm. He's on the line with us from Boston. You can join the conversation as well, 410-662-8780, our Twitter handle at Midday Tom Hall, our email midday@WIPR. Let's go to the phones. LB in Baltimore, welcome to Midday. Thanks for your call.
Hey, Tom, can you hear me okay?
I can as well. I can very well, sir. What's on your mind?
You. We talked before in the summer. So, I'm a lifelong Baltimorean, graduated from high school, Mount St. Joe, didn't go to college, but was always able to get a job. And I remember when Reagan in the 80s came in, there was the same kind of feeling, and yet that was the best time for me. I worked at Goucher College over 10 years, and we had a session on becoming more tolerant. And yet when you looked, housekeeping, all black to one side, machine shop, all white to the other. And yet we did learn to get along. That's why I think a lot of this really is economics. Immigrants didn't steal jobs. They were hired by the corporations. And so that's why I'm saying it's more economics than anything. And I believe in America. I think we'll be all right.
And did you vote for Mr. Trump, sir?
No. I'll be honest, I knew Hillary was going to carry Maryland, and I didn't really prefer her either. I think it's true. This was one of the worst elections I know since I've been alive, and I've been alive since, Kennedy at least. So,
all right. Well,
I just think I'm worried too about Medicare because I'll be 65 in 2 years, and I'm on Social Security now. So yeah, I'm worried. And as the doctor said, it's your own self-interest that's when you perk up and see things.
Well, LB, I appreciate the call. Thanks for calling, and glad you could join the show today. John in Baltimore, welcome to Midday. Glad you could call as well. What's on your mind?
Is that me?
Yes, sir. What's on your mind?
Well, the fellow from Boston, I completely disagree with what he had to say. And Chris Matthews is not a very good example to use in this because he pushed for Hillary in 2008 like she was going to be anointed, and then he did it again this year. And so, I just negate that. But this has been going on for a long time. Whether it's Grover Norquist saying that they will not let Democrats, even if they win, govern, they'll throw a wrench into the works. The first night the night before the inauguration of Obama in 2008, the leaders of the Republican Party got together and said, "We're not going to let this guy do anything." And then the natural extension of that is a crazy person like Trump, who I think is a sociopath. There's nothing to indicate from his past life, and I've followed him back to the 70s. I'm an old guy. And he has never done anything that's redeemable other than make his family wealthy and him wealthy, which he was given that money in the first place.
Well, John, I appreciate the call. Of course, Mr. Trump has been elected president of the United States. So, when it comes to doing something, that's certainly something in the eyes of many. Jack Marshall, your response. I mean, what is the role, the ethical role or the ethically justifiable role of the loyal opposition? I mean, Mitch McConnell, John Boehner, John is right in that the day of the inauguration at the lunch, right after the lunch, they basically announced that they were going to be the party of no. And what happened was that was a very effective political strategy because they won the midterm elections in 10. They lost the presidency in 2012, but they won the midterms again in 14. And now they control all three branches of government in 2016. What's the ethically justifiable way to oppose Mr. Trump?
Well, for one thing, two wrongs don't make a right. I mean, going back, I was arguing with some people, some Republicans who said after the election, yeah, we're gonna treat the Democrats exactly the way they treated us. That's not ethical. That's tit for tat vengeance. I think a lot of the representations of how the Republicans dealt with Obama are distorted and misstated, but let's presume they're all right. Still not a healthy way to handle the country, and so it is not ideal to treat Mr. Trump the way everyone would have wished Mr. Obama to be treated, which is to say with everybody giving them the chance and trying to accomplish what needs to be accomplished. We're in a different situation right here, of course. Mr. Obama had Congress entirely aligned with him when he was elected, and so the Republicans were taking the position of being obstructing what they thought was going to be an excessively liberal agenda. Now the Democrats, who bitterly complained that was an unethical approach, are saying they want to do the same thing. That's the problem with this, is the idea is, again, to sit back, to decide we're all Americans, and to be reasonable. And I want to address the issue about words. Much of the reason that Donald Trump was elected was a sense that for 8 years or longer, the idea has been being hammered into the youth of America that words should be banned, words should be punished, words are weapons. When in fact, words are in fact the strength of the United States of America, and why we have a First Amendment that extends well beyond what is permitted in Britain and Germany and in most of Europe.
But hold on, Mr. Marshall. In what ways have over the last 8 years during the Obama administration have words been, or has the notion been hammered into children that words should be banned?
Look at speech codes. Go to fire. Go look at the.
What is fire? I don't know what that is.
What is it? It's the foundation for the fire. You can find it online. But basically what they do is police speech codes that punish students for offensive words. And we constantly see pure matter of offense being justification for people being punished, being fired, being ostracized. And that has grown. That is the political correctness issue that Mr. Trump wrote on. He went way beyond what political correctness into absolute vulgarity and boorishness, but people felt that a strike needed to be made for the First Amendment, which is a core value in this country, and I think that position should be respected and not just brushed aside as a weapon of privilege. We should be able to talk to each other and not simply declare that certain opinions, certain ideas are taboo and mean that the individual stating them should be shunned. Saying one opposes illegal immigration should not recall somebody being called a xenophobe or a racist. They're not the same thing.
All right, Jack Marshall.
Making fun of women by talking about grabbing them and their genitals is by far not words that we should be brushing off. And I think that a lot of the women that I see, I've already had conversations with them about being triggered by traumatic speech. So the idea that we're trying to censor public speech or free speech by saying, let's be respectful, let's be conscious of the words that we use, the names that the labels that we give to whole groups of people like rapists and murderers, being respectful of groups of people is very different than censoring free speech.
I want to move to a phone call now. Lakey in Baltimore, you've been very patient. Thank you for your patience, and welcome to Midday.
Hi. I just actually want to co-sign on what Dr. Carter said about this being the suggestion, the notion that we shouldn't be afraid is definitely dependent on your privilege in this country. If you're a white man, no, you don't need to be concerned about what Donald Trump said. But if you are a person of color, if you are a woman, then you have nothing, no choice but to believe that Donald Trump meant everything that he said, everything that he has said before he was running for president, and everything that he said during the campaign. And for me, that makes me, as a black woman in Baltimore, not necessarily fearful for my safety, but fearful for the course that this country will take under his leadership, or in the inclusion of Steve Bannon in his administration in the number two position, certainly does not give hope that he will not follow through with the things that he said, building a wall between us and Mexico, forcing the deportation of people who have lived in this country or been born in, well, not born, but grew up in this country as children, not allowing Muslims to immigrate here. I mean, it's all reprehensible, and to suggest that there should be, that it's an overreaction from people in my position to protest him, to vow to do whatever we can to keep him from enacting this agenda, is white privilege stark and in bold relief.
Well, Lakey, thank you for your call. I appreciate it. Hugh Morales, Frank Bruni, who is known to be a left of center columnist for the New York Times, wrote in yesterday's paper that we run the danger of having political correctness morphing into moral purity. I mean, this notion that Jack Marshall talks about speech codes and Trump uses, and Trump and a lot of people on the right use the term political correctness. And as Dr. Carter mentions, there's also a matter of basic decency and consideration for another human being. But has the left gone too far in terms of political correctness and monitoring or policing speech in this country? And is that provoked, or is that a dimension of this very stark divide we now have politically in the country?
The left has not, in my mind, gone too far in the sense of defending the inherent worth of every individual. The idea that you can use words that dehumanize and marginalize and threaten other people, when that happens, whether it's a university campus or in a business setting or something, that's not an issue of First Amendment. That's an issue of basic decency and ethical behavior with each other. The First Amendment applies to the government stopping words from being said in censorship. And this is what I think people are missing the point. The real danger is where Trump is sitting. He has intimidated journalists. He has tried to repress certain things. I am worried about the First Amendment, which is why I'm doubling my contribution to the ACLU, because I think transparency, freedom of the press, if that goes, we are in bigger trouble than ever. So I do not equate people discussing what is the more ethical way to refer to each other in certain settings. First Amendment issues are government responsibilities.
I'm Tom Hall. You're listening to Midday. That's Hugh Taft Morales. He leads the Baltimore and the Philadelphia Ethical Societies. On the line from Baltimore, Dr. Lakeeta Carter. She's a licensed psychologist and the owner of the Institute for Healing. And on the line from Boston, Jack Marshall, the president and founder of Pro Ethics. Our phone number, 410-662-8780. Our email address, midday@wypr.org. And our Twitter handle, @midday. Tom Hall. We're going to grab one more phone call before we take a little break. Christine in Baltimore, thanks for your call and welcome to Midday.
Good afternoon. Thank you. It's an interesting discussion. The reason that I called in, I'm a first-time caller. The reason that I called in is because through social media and personal experiences over the course of the last week, it has become, aside from the feelings that have been expressed by friends and my own sense of loss that this election demonstrates, I have realized that the ethical and important place I have is to, through my behavior and my words and my actions, to stand up for and stop what I see as inappropriate, unkind, inflammatory words and actions being demonstrated in the public by people. So if I see racism occurring, not just to shake my head, but to go and let the person who I see being doing something racist, to ask them, what's going on? Why is this okay? What is it that you're trying to get at here?
And Christine, is that something that heretofore you would not have done? Is this a new commitment that you're making to yourself?
No, it is something that I would have done before. What I'm saying is it's broadened now. I feel so strongly that we can't let anything contribute and add to the sense that we have right now in the community that it's okay to engage in these kinds of things.
All right. Well, Christine, I appreciate the call. We got to take a little break. Dr. Lakeeta Carter joins us on the phone. She's a psychologist and the owner of the Institute for Healing. Jack Marshall's also on the phone. He's the president and founder of ProEthics, an ethical and training consulting firm. And Hugh Taft Morales leads the Baltimore and Philadelphia Ethical Societies. He's with me here in the studio. You can be with us on the phone, on the email, or on the Twitter, 410-662-8780. Our email address, midday@wypr.org, or Twitter handle, @MiddayTomHall. We're coming back in 90 seconds. Stick around. Welcome back to Midday on 88.1 WIPR. I'm Tom Hall. Tom, another Tom from Frederick, Maryland, sends us an email and mentions that Kellyanne Conway, who's the campaign manager for the Trump campaign, according to the Washington Post, is said to have its, quote, it's up to Clinton and Obama to calm anti-Trump protesters. And he asks, should President-elect Trump step up to leadership and take actions to calm protesters and show that he's listening as the president of us all? I mean, Jack Marshall, there's a lot of talk about Trump's temperament and his fitness to be president during the campaign. Is the fact that he was elected just sort of a priori proof that he is he's qualified to hold the office?
No, of course not. And in fact, he's not fit. I'm disturbed about it as anybody else. However, he can still become fit and he can still turn it around, and he can still get responsible people, and he can still try to do what's best for the entire country, and he can still listen. And it's up to him to demonstrate that.
Has he demonstrated that in any way, to your reckoning, in these last few days as the protests have taken place, and, for example, with the appointment of Steve Bannon to be a senior advisor? Is that a demonstration of what you're talking about?
I was as troubled by his appointment of Rance Priebus, which I thought had the appearance of impropriety and made me wonder if he had struck a deal with the chairman of the RNC at the stage when the RNC could have shut down Trump's candidacy. No, he hasn't done anything. He hasn't done anything blatantly, blatantly alarming. But so far, I haven't seen anything that shows a U-turn. But I also think it's unreasonable to expect that so quickly. If I were Donald Trump, who I believe very strongly ran simply as sort of a promotional exercise and never thought in a million years this would happen and is as shocked as anyone else, I would feel like a train ran over me. And just as I feel we should all have some compassion for Hillary Clinton, who was certain she was going to be the first woman president, I think we need to have a different kind of compassion for Donald Trump and imagine from a golden rule standpoint how we would feel if we suddenly found ourselves in the middle of the spotlight with the most difficult job in the world and knowing that we're really not prepared for it. And I suspect he knows that.
Here's an email with a question for Dr. Lakeeta Carter. It's from Michael. He asked, does Dr. Carter think that President Obama shares the blame for our current president-elect? President Obama really enjoyed mercilessly humiliating Donald Trump at two White House press corps dinners. Does she think that Obama ought not to have engaged in humiliating a billionaire narcissist who had massive popular appeal? Dr. Carter, what do you say?
That's a good question. I think that one of the things we talk about in multicultural psychology is that every person and everything has a context, and that whenever you look at something out of context, you are missing that thing or that person. And so you can think about your own behavior on a Saturday afternoon after you've been frustrated by your kids or your partner and you have to work later on that day, and then someone cuts you off. So looking at behavior out of context is very dangerous, okay? The press corps dinner that is referenced is a place where roasting happens. That's the context, and that is the culture of that event. So no, I don't think it was any different than him poking fun at himself, which he did during those dinners, and him poking fun at other people during the specific journalists, all of it. I mean, at one point he said something about Matt Damon's latest movie. You know, I think that that's the context of the event, and so no, I don't think that had anything to do with people's reaction to this or Donald Trump's reaction.
On 88.1, it's midday. I'm Tom Hall. Our telephone number, 410-662-8780. Our email address, midday@wipr.org, and our Twitter handle, @MiddayTomHall. Hugh Taft Morales, let's take, for example, the instance of people in rural America who for the first time in a long time had a very significant role in this election. They seem to be worried about immigrants. Perhaps they're worried about corporate America, agribusiness. Perhaps they're getting their information from this echo chamber that people identify as part of the problems. Leon Wieseltier wrote a terrific essay in the Post last Friday, and he references that, and he says that the scapegoating of otherness, which is to say the scapegoating by people in rural America, at least to some degree, the scapegoating of otherness by miserable people cannot be justified by their misery. How does one ethically approach this? These are people who clearly are hurting. It's clear that perhaps the Democratic Party has not done much over the last 8 years, perhaps even longer, to address their very legitimate, deep-seated concerns. How do you reckon those two things?
Well, I think you do have to take into account the idea that Mr. Marshall brought up about looking at the golden rule. How would they feel? And yes, I do think people in those areas have been hurt. I think the middle class has been squeezed. We have very little hope in a lot of families that they can send their kids to college or that they can retire with any. So there's fear. But I don't think we need to then say, okay, you're saying you didn't vote for Trump because you're a racist, you're not a racist, you're not a misogynist, but you did vote for Trump despite the comments that he made. And I think that has to be honored. That truth has to be honored. But I do think it's important to try to look for dialogue and personal relationships between people who have not talked to each other because of the siloing of our cultures. There's no conversation. The fact that so many people on the East and West Coast were shocked at the election results when a lot of people elsewhere in the country said we saw it happening. We have to get the public dialogue going.
Lee writes an email and says, how should we measure a man except by his words? Isn't it considered a high form of praise that someone is, quote, a man of his word? How can we set aside all the words that Mr. Trump used at his rallies and assume that he will be different in his role as president? Steve in Baltimore, welcome to Midday. Glad you could call.
Hey, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. How are you today?
I'm fine, man. Thanks for calling.
So I got a comment. I keep hearing people saying, you know, not all Trump supporters are racist, and I certainly agree with that. I think that's a wild allegation to make. But I do think Trump supporters, at least a lot of the middle-class white Americans in the middle of the country, have a well-known history of voting against their own economic self-interest. I mean, I think we've even seen whole books written about this, not that I expect that Donald Trump would have read any of them. But we cannot really make the claim that these people are both not racist and well-informed. Either they are racist and very well-informed, in which case they got exactly what they wanted, which is somebody who's going to appoint someone like Stephen Bannon to a top position, and so they got what they voted for, or else they are not racist, which I'm willing to believe, but they're certainly not well-informed, because in their attempt to, as they say, throw a brick through Washington's window, they ended up really electing the face of corporate handouts in America, somebody who possibly bribed the New York attorney so she wouldn't investigate him, somebody took millions of dollars in subsidies from New Jersey so that he could just basically screw over the entire city of Atlantic City and plenty of people who worked for him. So if they're not racist, that's fine. I'm willing to believe that. But they did not vote well-informed. Thank you for taking my call.
Well, you know, it's interesting that we've talked on this program with a number of analysts and pundit types who've said, you know, they were informed. They did know what he did. They do know what he said on the bus with Billy Bush. They do know what he said about Obama and the birther movement, you know, for years prior to running. They do know a lot of stuff, and I appreciate the call, but they do know a lot of stuff. And as you say, Hugh Morales, they sort of ignored it. I want to make sure people are up to speed on Steve Bannon, in case you don't know who he is. He's been appointed by President-elect Trump as a senior advisor and chief strategist. It's been reported that Mr. Trump assumes that Mr. Bannon will be equal to Reince Priebus, who is the chief of staff. That's obviously the most powerful office in the West Wing. NBC News, The Washington Post, many other sources are reporting this morning that Breitbart News, the operation that Steve Bannon has run for the past many years, has espoused anti-Semitic views, white nationalist views. It has been criticized regularly for its close ties to the alt-right. He has called, Mr. Bannon has called the Pope a commie. He said that Catholics are trying to boost Hispanic immigration because their church is dying. He once referred to the Civil War as the War of Southern Independence that was fought over economic development. The kinds of views that he's espousing are incredibly radical on the right. Dr. Carter, we've heard a lot about parents who've had a difficult time discussing this election with their children. Have you heard that in your practice? And how do you counsel parents whose little kids, 8, 10, 12 years old, are upset about this election?
Sure, I've heard a lot of that. Or a lot of people going to work and not really being able to connect with coworkers like they used to because they're just not sure where people fall. Lots of silence, pregnant silence, if you will. So one of the things that we do, and we pull things down to a child's level and we use words that are age appropriate. You know, we talk about how this is America and people vote for who they want to be the president, and that usually means that a good portion of the country doesn't get what they want. And that's really no different than when you and your sister or you and your brother, you know, want to make a decision about where we eat for dinner. And if you have two different ideas, then at some point somebody's not going to get what they want. And how words have power. So that's one end of the fence. The other end of the fence is that words have power, that words can destroy and words can build, that what you say in the past does matter about how you think and how you behave, that, and this is a really important one, that just because it's not happening to your group doesn't mean it doesn't matter. You know, that's something that I've been hearing for the last 18 months. Well, he hasn't said anything about this group. You know, and so there's this idea that it doesn't affect me until it affects me. And that is just, in so many ways, short-sighted and lacking in tolerance and sensitivity. Because
right.
There are many things that should affect us, even if it does, if they're not pointed to our group.
Well, Dr. Carter, we're going to have to make that the last word. I apologize to the folks on the phone we weren't able to get to. Dr. Lakita Carter is a licensed psychologist in private practice. She owns the Institute for Healing. She was also at one time the director of psychology division for the Loyola Clinical Centers here in Baltimore. Jack Marshall has joined us on the phone from Boston. He's the president and founder of Pro Ethics. And for more information about the work that they're doing, you can visit us at WIPR.org/midday. I'm also thankful to Hugh Taft Morales, who leads the Baltimore and Philadelphia Ethical Society. So thanks to all of you, and thanks for everybody who called. We also want to thank the Diz for providing lunch today. The Diz is located at 300 West 30th Street in the heart of Remington. They feature signature burgers, wings, steaks, and jumbo lump crab cakes. The Diz is open for lunch and dinner with breakfast served on the weekends. They can be found on the web at thedizbaltimore.com. That's it for Midday today. Coming up tomorrow, a one-on-one conversation with Plank Industries CEO Tom Geddes about the future of Port Covington. Why has Plank Industries decided to invest in such a big way in Baltimore? And given the TIF deal that's now in effect, what can Baltimore expect in return? Tom Geddes will take my questions and your questions tomorrow on Midday at noon right here on 88.1 WIPR. I'm Tom Hall. For all of us on the Midday team, thanks so much for listening. We'll see you tomorrow. Have a great day.
This is your NPR News Station 88.1.